Hey, it's Andrew Siciliano. Does anyone want to trade for Keon Coleman? Coming up on Inside Coverage, what Terry Pegula and Brandon Bean said today at their press conference in Buffalo. Oh boy, that raised some eyebrows. Baker Mayfield takes a shot at Kevin Stefanski, and Liam Cohen and Robert Saleh in the same division. What's that like? I'll ask Eric Armstead. He's played for them both. Jory Epstein, yours truly. Inside Coverage next. It's a Championship Wednesday edition of Inside Coverage. Welcome, everybody, from the home office in Southern California. My name is Andrew Siciliano, the how and the why, any and everything you need to know about the National Football League. Championship Wednesday is, it's kind of something that the networks created, meaning NFL Network and ESPN, to like put all the press conferences on. We're down to four teams. And here are their press conferences, coach and quarterback and defensive stars and offensive stars. And we're down to only three more NFL games. Let's just run these live all day. But today kind of turned into a day in which the headlines were made at press conferences for teams other than the four left standing. I promise we'll get to the football, and we'll get to Eric Armstead as well, the Jaguars defensive lineman who played three of the four teams that are still standing, three of the four that are in the Final Four, and a guy that also played for Robert Saleh and plays for Liam Cohen. How is that going to go this year? Eric Armstead right around the corner. How is this going to go, however, for the next hour? It's going to go fantastic because Jory Epstein is here, our senior NFL writer for Yahoo. Jory Epstein back from a 20-something run, 20 degrees, that is, through New York City, braving the elements to work around those press conferences for a workout. How are you?
I am doing well, Andrew, and I think you're just trying to rub in my face that you had a 59-degree, which was cold by your standard run. But yes, I have my whole schedule for these runs, where I'll do half podcasts of reporters talking about the NFL, like, here's what Sean Payton said, here's what Mike Vrabel said. I make a playlist before I go out. And really, the win of the run was that I didn't slip on any ice, because it's definitely still a bit snowy in New York. So I was very careful, and I was like, better to slow down a little bit than to slip. So, you know, you can't run the next day if you fall.
I believe Sean McVay said that today as well, along with his, what, excuses are for the ignorant, or excuses, something like that. Yeah, we should put that on a t-shirt. You can't run the next day if you fall. Also, YouTube hack and Twitter hack. So I'm the guy that listens to podcasts. It used to be 1.5, then it went to 1.75. Now I'm up to 2x, honestly. I just found out last night, because I posted it and said, hey, can anyone help me? And then I figured it out. You can do YouTube. You can change the YouTube speed on your videos. Did you know that?
I've been doing that for a while. My biggest thing was, it was funny, I was listening to podcasts on 1.8, and then I listened to the Denver Broncos beat reporters on 1.5x, and I was like, this feels normal speed. And I literally pulled my phone back out during my run, which, like, you don't want to do if you don't really need to check something, to make sure it was on 1.5, because I'm like, maybe people just talk a lot faster in New York, but this feels like 1x. So yes, you can. And if you have YouTube Premium, you can make the whole playlist. So all the things, whether you're driving or running, it's really helpful for binging.
You can do it on Twitter as well. Yeah, as long as they're not live press conferences. Obviously, you can't speed those up live, but I missed Vrabel today. So on my run, I put Vrabel on.
Yeah, Terry Pegula. I was trying to catch up.
You speed it up. Yes.
I was like 7 minutes behind on the Terry Pegula.
Yeah.
Let me go faster.
Okay. Let's get to that, because that was the bonkers press conference of all ownership bonkers press conferences. It was 10 Eastern, 7 Pacific. I, as mentioned, am in Southern California. When I found out that would be at 10 a.m. this morning, specifically set my alarm for 6. I wanted to get up, get caffeinated, and sit down. I didn't make popcorn because it's only 7 a.m. I'm not going to eat popcorn for breakfast, but I figured it would be fun. And oh boy, it was fun. Here's Terry Pegula, the owner of the Buffalo Bills, with Brandon Bean by his side, explaining why and when he decided to fire head coach Sean McDermott.
I did not fire a coach based on a bad officiating decision. If I can take you into that locker room, I felt like we hit the proverbial playoff wall year after year. 13 seconds, missed field goals, the catch. So I just sensed in that locker room, like, where do we go from here with what we have? And that was the basis for my decision.
And then he went on to say, maybe I'm wrong. Now, that quote, if that was it, that would be fine. It was an owner saying, I went with my gut. I decided that I had to move on from my head coach. We couldn't get over the hump in the postseason. It had been 9 years. He opened the presser, Jory, by thanking Sean McDermott for his contributions and thanked his family and said he's a good man and all those things. If that was it, we wouldn't be sitting here leading with this. But Terry Pegula repeatedly, through his nearly hour-long press conference, said this team has a great roster, said he decided to keep Brandon Bean because clearly he felt Brandon Bean was doing a better job than Sean McDermott. He said he did not consult with Josh Allen, and he continually took Bean's side when it came down to why him and not the coach, including in the most awkward exchange of the day, when Bean was asked about not getting wide receivers, about calling into local radio shows and criticizing those hosts for criticizing him for not getting wide receivers. And they brought up Keon Coleman, who was the 33rd overall pick 2 years ago. Here's that answer.
Yeah, can I interrupt? I'll address the Keon situation. The coaching staff pushed to draft Keon. I'm not saying Brandon wouldn't have drafted him, but he wasn't his next choice. That was Brandon being a team player and taking advice of his coaching staff, who felt strongly about the player. And, you know, he's taken, for some reason, heat over it and not saying a word about it. But I'm here to tell you the true story.
I don't know that I've ever seen anything like that. For the record, that was a GM asked about a player who has not lived up to his draft position. The owner cutting off the GM, Jory, and saying the GM didn't want him. The coach I just fired is the one that actually wanted
him. Yeah, the whole thing is wild. And it's also funny because people always think that Jerry Jones says crazy things. It turns out Jerry Jones is not even close to the craziest of owners when they talk. He just talks a lot more because he's both team owner and general manager. I think when you look at Terry Pegula, Terry Pegula's job in that press conference was to explain himself, to defend Brandon Bean, and to sell this job to the next Buffalo Bills head coaching candidate. And so if you feel like Brandon Bean made a bad call on a personnel and he's now been promoted and you're going to have to answer to him, then why would you as the head coach want to come there? And so I think that for Terry, it's really easy of like, okay, let's say it's true, Andrew, that Josh Allen and Sean McDermott and Brandon Bean all wanted Keon Coleman. Well, two of them are still in the building, so it's easiest to blame the other one. Now, the fact that they were doing this on the record in a public setting with this guy still on the team is absolutely bonkers. I agree. I think that it's not the first time we've seen it, anything close to this, but this level of it is kind of like, hello, do you know that he's still here? I also want to go back to the playoff wall part for a minute, because I was at the Bills game 2 years ago when in the divisional round. It was actually 2 years ago today when we're recording this, and they hosted the Kansas City Chiefs and they lost on a missed field goal. And I just remember being in that locker room, and I reread that story today, and I was shocked by how similar it felt and how relevant it felt to right now. I was in that locker room and I was kind of trying to watch Josh Allen, even if it meant I missed some interviews, because I'm like, if I'm going to be here at this game, I want to get a feel for it. And 36 minutes after the game had ended, Josh was still in his uniform, just sitting at his locker. He wasn't really talking to people. Maybe someone would come for a hug here or there, but he was just so upset. It wasn't quite the tears and the active devastation that we saw this year in Denver, but there was this just kind of like, I don't even know the answers. It took him a few 6 seconds, according to my story, then before he answered the first question about what went wrong and how he felt like they failed. And I was wondering when I was in that locker room if they would keep Sean McDermott. And the question, and I still feel this, is not whether Sean McDermott's a good football coach. I think he's a good football coach. I personally think he's a great one. Maybe you need someone to win a Super Bowl to be great. I don't really think that's the threshold in a league where 31 teams don't win it every year and one does, obviously. What I think is interesting, though, is there was kind of this repetitive notion of if the head coach, GM, and quarterback are typically the ones who are making the most impact on the team every year, and seven tries and you're not having the success, do you have to change something? Now, I know a lot of people say, well, then why wouldn't you get rid of Brandon Bean? But I think it's harder for team owners to put a finger on, here's what changing the GM would do. They feel more like, I watched this end of game decision. I watched these turnovers. My coach didn't have them ready. And then also, as we've talked about on this show before, the head coach is on the sideline during the game. The GM is often with the team owner. And so they're the ones talking mm-hmm. through it. And they're kind of like the proxy to team owner. But I'm just curious what you think of all that, because I'm not defending most of what Terry Pegula said. But in terms of the decision, even though I think very highly of Sean McDermott and that he'll have success at his next stop, did you not need to change something?
So I'm with you. And I'm not in any way surprised Sean McDermott got fired. Both can be true. He's a fantastic coach who was like 95 and 50 and will get another job and will make the next team for which he coaches a better team. And it's probably time for a change. Both can be true. If that were the message today, I think it wouldn't have made news. It would have just been another owner going through the motions, explaining why he decided to move on. And then we'll see if it's any better next year with the next guy. But that's not what today was. That was an owner who repeatedly, and maybe he was tired of the line of questioning, but an owner who repeatedly defended why the GM sitting next to him was keeping his job and the coach was fired. And on more than one occasion, he said that they had, this is the owner, a great roster. The rest of the NFL doesn't agree with that assessment. I think that's fair to say. I think we, all of us on this show, you, me, Frank, Charles, whomever, Ben, have said that while this might have been the best path to a Super Bowl because all the other big name quarterbacks are gone in the AFC, this was in no way the Bills' best team. And there had been some reporting. Vic Carucci, longtime Buffalo reporter, said yesterday that he had heard McDermott had openly questioned the roster to both ownership and the GM in recent weeks. There had been subtle digs. Some read them as subtle digs. McDermott praising, say, the Jaguars for their acquisition of Jacoby Myers, or clearly he was seething with the whole Darius Slay and Jamarcus Ingram thing. So there was a bit of a disconnect. But when you throw in the Keon Coleman quotient here, I kind of felt bad for Brandon Bean at a time for part of it, because he's sitting, I guarantee you there's part of him going, will you just please stop? Please, please, please. Because I do think, and they still have Josh Allen and an amazing fan base and a brand new stadium. They're a good, proud organization. But I do think that a little bit of the shine is off this job. Now, is Brian Daboll going to turn it down if they call him up? Just throwing a name out there. No, I don't think so. I don't think it's going to limit their candidate pool. But are there people looking at Buffalo right now going, oof, that's what I'm dealing with? Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know. Do you feel like it would be different if this was a case where, like Jerry Jones, Terry Pegula was speaking to the media three times a week instead of like so rarely that the Buffalo reporters had podcasts the day before being like, well, we're not going to hear from Terry Pegula because we never do. And they weren't just speaking haphazardly. They know because they'd been there. I also think that it's kind of funny. Really, anytime we hear from team owners, my top takeaway is you guys are way too online and you're so aware of everything everyone is saying about you. Now, last year when the Cowboys were hiring Brian Schottenheimer and Jerry was so like, and I know you guys think this is uncreative and I know you think that this is a lazy pick and I just don't want to pay someone. Here's why, why you're wrong. And then for Terry Pegula, it was very much like, I know you guys think Keon Coleman's not right. I know you don't like the receiver room. Like, you don't even have to feed them some of the questions because they're so aware of the narratives and the criticism that they often bring it up themselves. I think when you want to talk about why Brandon Bean kept his job, it comes down to one thing, which is why we've seen GMs routinely outlast coaches when they don't have success. If you find a quarterback in a league where quarterback demand far outweighs quarterback supply, whether or not you win with that quarterback, you have gotten just a gold star from ownership that will last you a long time. We saw this with the Chargers.
And Pagula said that today.
Pagula said, hey, the guy sitting next to me is the guy that found Josh Allen.
That's
literally, I have it highlighted on my screen. He said, I don't know if anyone knows it in this room, but Josh Allen wouldn't be here if it wasn't for this guy pushing and pushing and pulling a Houdini in that draft to get to the position where we could pick him. So when you find a quarterback, and that when you find a good quarterback, Justin Herbert's played very well. He hasn't probably maxed out his potential. And Tom Telesco kept that job forever because of it. This is an MVP quarterback, the reigning MVP. So yeah, Brandon Bean's going to get a little bit because the same way in New York, you're seeing Jackson Dart help Joe Shane keep the job. And oh, by the way these team owners think about it is the best thing I have to sell coaching candidates is the quarterback, and the quarterback is who the GM found for me. And so the GM is like also helping you find the coach in that situation. Now, I don't know whether Brandon Bean keeps all the responsibility if they want. I mean, like, let's say they were to go after Mike Tomlin or something, and I don't think Mike Tomlin's coaching this year, if ever, again, in the NFL. I think that Mike Tomlin would get the control he wanted because the same way we saw with John Harbaugh in New York, if you have the leverage, you can get it if they want you. But I do think that that's what this comes down to. We don't have to like it, but if a GM finds a quarterback or hits on a quarterback, they're gonna get, and especially one like this where they traded up to get him. And Josh Allen was pretty raw. This wasn't like the obvious first overall pick Matthew Stafford type situation.
No, it wasn't. He went 7 overall. The Bills traded up. And stop me if I've done this on the show before. I'm going to do it again. Not everyone listens to every show. The what if, the sliding doors of the NFL, if you go back to the 2018 draft, just answer the question out loud, play this game. Where would any of those other five franchises actually ahead of the Bills be if they had taken Josh Allen? 2018, the Browns pick one, they pick Baker Mayfield. We'll get to Baker coming up in a bit. He at least went to the playoffs. He has had success in the NFL. Pick number two was Saquon Barkley. Obviously, we know how that has gone. Pick three was Sam Darnold. Pick four was the Browns again. They took Denzel Ward. They weren't going to pick a quarterback twice, but they had a second shot at Josh Allen, hypothetically. Pick five was Bradley Chubb to the Broncos. Pick six was Quentin Nelson to the Colts. Could be in the Hall of Fame one day. Fantastic player. But how about the Colts with Josh Allen? How about the Broncos with Josh Allen? How about the Browns with Josh Allen? How about the Giants with Josh Allen? How about the Jets with Josh Allen? Anybody could have had him. It didn't happen. Brandon Bean, to his credit, traded up, and he got him, and it worked. So, yay. Like, that is awesome. It should also be pointed out that while Keon Coleman didn't work either, Brandon Bean, after they realized they had something in Josh Allen, did go out and get him a weapon. They went and they traded a one to Minnesota for Stephon Diggs. So they have gone down that road before as well. But the last year, it's been contentious. And Keon Coleman has had some off-field issues. He hasn't been the player that they thought they were going to get. And Bean pointed that out today as well. Off-field issues, maturity issues, in essence. But Keon Coleman now heard those comments. And, I mean, Twitter was awash today with people going, well, you can call him up and get him for a bag of donuts right now. Keon Coleman can be had. Everybody call Brandon Bean. I would hate to be Keon Coleman. It's a horrible position to be in when your phone is blowing up and the owner of the football team is talking about you like that. It feels awful. Also, not to totally contradict Terry Pagula, because who knows what draft meetings are actually like behind the scenes. And every GM, whenever they draft a player, says, this is the guy we wanted. He was the one on our board, and we all agreed we're going to get this guy. There are videos the Bills put out from their draft room talking about, we're going to get him. Brandon Bean said it after the fact. Hey, because they were picking first in the second round that night. They had all day to listen to phone calls. We knew if we weren't blown away by an offer, we're taking Keon Coleman. And then they have a video from him watching the combine from the suite in Indianapolis, celebrating that Keon Coleman didn't run well because that meant he would have fallen to the draft and they could take him. So there are receipts here, which made the whole thing, Jory, even more awkward.
I think I just realized why I wasn't so stunned that this was happening. And it's because just 3 months ago, I was in the lobby of a New York hotel as Woody Johnson, in the middle of the season, was talking about how with Justin Fields, the quarterback was why they weren't winning, he couldn't complete a pass, et cetera. So Yes, it's not great when the guy's still on your roster, but when Woody did this to Justin Fields, who's the quarterback of the team, who needed to be a leader, he was doing things right off the field, unlike Keon Coleman, I think it's fair to say. And on top of that, it was still the middle of the season and they had to go play games. Now you're not in the building. You don't have to answer to everyone. So I think this is why I'm like, these owners do this.
And there's been, and I've already seen a parallel. Oh, by the way, I don't know if I put this in our chat earlier, but the favorite, because I tweeted the quote from Pegula, and I wasn't the only one that tweeted it, but, you know, you're getting all the responses there. A Browns fan immediately responded, ask Brandon Bean whose decision it was to trade a 3 for Amari Cooper. And that made everyone in my Browns chat laugh and laugh aloud. He traded a 3 for Amari Cooper, not 8 months after Amari Cooper put up 265 yards on a Christmas Eve game in Houston. So, like, Amari Cooper just fell off a cliff somehow. He's a nice guy. I like him. But, you know, the Browns got a 3. They turned that 3 into Dylan Gabriel. That's another conversation. Where was I? Real quick. The video. Oh, I know what I was going to say. So I was in the room last year in Palm Beach when Browns owner Jimmy Haslam said they took a big swing and missed on Deshaun Watson. And I've seen people compare Pegula's comments today to Jimmy Haslam's comments on Deshaun Watson. I don't think there's any comparison. We're talking about a quarterback versus a wide receiver. But when it came to Deshaun Watson, this was after a second Achilles injury. And to me, it was a necessary, even though Deshaun was still in the building, it was a necessary concession, admission, call it what you want to your fan base to say, hey, listen, we know, we tried, it didn't work. We know we have to pick ourselves up off the mat collectively as an organization. We have a hole to dig ourselves out of. We know that was, blame me if you want to blame me. We know, we hear you. If it makes anyone feel any better, Jimmy Haslam was at Deshaun Watson's wedding a couple of months later. So while the comments publicly, you went, oh boy. In the grand scheme of things, it wasn't the end of the world. I'm sure Keon Coleman will bounce back, but yeah, I mean.
Jimmy Haslam also paid for Deshaun Watson's wedding, but that's another story. I do think it's worth noting, though. I think it's worth noting, though, that.
You mean literally or figuratively because he's the owner and size?
No, he got a $230 million fully guaranteed contract. Okay. That's helpful for planning. As someone who planned a wedding this year, weddings are expensive. And my wedding, I'm sure, looked nothing like Deshaun Watson is at the synagogue I grew up at. But alas, if you pay the guy that much money.
Yahoo paid for your wedding.
Yeah. Alas. I think it's worth considering the impact of when team owners talk, because I understand there can be a lot of criticism, but I also think a spin zone on this is if Sean McDermott was still here and Terry Pegula hadn't said anything, I recognize that we all still think Josh Allen's a great quarterback, but we would be talking a lot more about the fact that he turned over the ball 5 times in the game against Denver, that he had those 2 interceptions and 3 fumbles. And I think that the more you put this on Terry Pegula, the less it's on the players, the less it's on the GM, the less it's on the coaching staff, even if I understand that it's a little bit disingenuous to say that because Sean McDermott's not there anymore. And so I think whether it's with Keon Coleman, and hey, there's also records, just like there is at Brandon Bean, of Josh Allen texting Keon Coleman right when he got it about how he'd watched film of Keon Coleman and he was the one that he wanted him. And when you talk about Sean McDermott's firing, and maybe Josh Allen was on board, we don't know, but Terry Pegula was like, I didn't tell him about it, but we are going to include him going forward. Now, would you make this decision without involving your quarterback? You might, but you also might just try and take the bullets for your quarterback. So again, I'm not saying that I would have handled things like Terry Pegula, but I do think that we have redirected a lot of the criticism away from the people who are most going to be in the locker room next year and onto the team owner, who is not around to talk that much during the season. And I don't know that that's always a bad thing.
You don't have to agree. No, I do agree with you, actually. I mean, it's a great point. There are also a lot of other great points that I feel like we're leaving out there. Terry Pegula was asked, why aren't you speaking more? Why aren't you out in front more? And he mentioned his wife, Kim, and her health struggles coming back from some serious health issues, and how much his family time has really taken up all his time, says he hasn't gotten a chance to go watch his daughter Jessica play tennis because he's always at home. So there's that angle as well. I think it also should be noted that Brandon Bean made a point of defending Sean McDermott and referenced, although he didn't mention Tyler Dunn by name, but the long form article a couple of years ago that really, really tore down Sean McDermott. And then the next week, they went to Kansas City. They beat the Chiefs, and Brandon Bean said he was standing with them before the game and after the game, and that shows you the kind of man that McDermott is. So there are a lot of layers to this press conference. It's not just a Keon Coleman getting thrown under the bus kind of thing, but that is how it will be remembered. You can forget all of it if the Bills go on and win next year, and Pegula was asked, is it Super Bowl or bust for the next guy? And he said, no, but it sure sounded that way. Sure sounds like Baker Mayfield has an issue with Kevin Stefanski. Coming up on Inside Coverage, the Twitter battle that you didn't know you needed today. Or maybe you don't. Don't go anywhere. So every day, not every day, but some days here on Inside Coverage, you get off the air, you look at your phone, and you go, ooh, look at that. Because there was something breaking as you were wrapping up the pod. Hi, I'm Andrew, by the way. Jory is here as well. Thanks for being here. The how and the why, any and everything you need to know about the National Football League. Jory, yesterday was one of those days. We wrapped up the show and, you know, closed down the home office here, went upstairs to the kitchen, looked at my phone and went, ooh, look at that Baker Mayfield tweet. So let's unpack it all. Because Baker's taken to Twitter and he is, I don't know, going back to an old beef. It all started when the dean of Falcons beat reporters, the great D. Orlando Ledbetter. You know when D. Orlando Ledbetter is in the room, he has a very unique voice. He very often asks the first question of Falcons pressers. I once sat in front of him on a media shuttle at a Super Bowl, and D. was sitting right behind me, kind of like that older guy on the plane who's on the cell phone and doesn't know that you should be whispering on a plane. And he was having a very loud conversation. Anyway, D tweeted that Baker Mayfield failed in Cleveland, in essence, trying to defend Kevin Stefanski's six-year tenure with the Browns by saying that Baker Mayfield and Deshaun Watson were failed quarterbacks. Okay. Baker noticed, even though he wasn't tagged in the initial tweet, Baker responded, and he said this. Okay, so here's the initial tweet by D. Orlando Ledbetter. Kevin Stefanski had a dumpster fire at quarterback in Cleveland. Baker Mayfield and Deshaun Watson failed, which started a chain reaction to 11 other starters. Quarterback Shador Sanders closed out last season with 7 starts. So there was an article there, which I could not read because I don't pay for the AJC, but that's neither here nor there. All right, so Baker saw it. No, he wasn't tagged in it. And Baker responded. Baker responded by saying, failed is quite the reach, pal. Now, he didn't use a comma, and that is significant. Bear with me here. He's calling D. Orlando Ledbetter pal. Still waiting on a text or call from him, meaning Stefanski, after I got shipped off like a piece of garbage. Can't wait to see you twice a year, comma, coach. I don't know why you properly used your comma in the last sentence, Baker, but didn't properly use a comma in the first part of the sentence or the first sentence. Also, when you call somebody pal, ugh, yeah, that's kind of dismissive. Not a good thing. So then Joe Thomas, the Hall of Famer, the Browns legend, a guy obviously who knows Baker, he's had a lot of time spent with Baker. Didn't play with him, but hey, whatever. All part of the family. Tweeted at Baker, I could be wrong, but I've heard that communication is a two-way street and there are no laws against you, Baker, sending Stefanski a text or calling
him. In parentheses.
Yes. After you got traded. Also, the emoji with the monocle. He's whipping out the monocle emoji as well. Anyway, it is on in Brownstown. And don't forget now that the Falcons and the Bucks in the NFC South are going to play each other twice a year. And I'll tell you right now, I'll plant the flag. The Buccaneers and the Falcons, Kevin Stefanski as new head coach, will be in primetime week one or week two. I'll all but guarantee it. It's probably the Monday night game. If there's a Monday night doubleheader, that could be one of the games. If not, how about the TNF opener, traditionally week two for Prime Video? Sign me up for that one. I don't care where the game is. There is a lot to unpack with this, certainly, which is a phrase I overuse. On the surface, I kind of agree with Joe. You know, it goes both ways. Should Kevin Stefanski, I don't know if he did or didn't. Would it have been nice if he had texted or called? Yeah, absolutely. We all like that. We all do. I don't know. Did ownership call? Were others in the building calling? Did it have to come from the coach? I don't know the answer. I have never discussed it with Kevin Stefanski. I was not there in 2021. But I don't know why you need to reignite that fire. I just don't know. It seems to me that you let your play do the talking. We know, Baker, that you always play with a chip on your shoulder. We know that you keep receipts. We know that it is part of what makes you a very good NFL player, at times a great NFL player, is you have that fire to fuel you. But I would have saved it for the Wednesday presser before that game, or maybe the offseason sit down with a random podcast wearing shorts and holding a beer. Like, I would have saved it for there because I think it looks kind of small and silly when you're out of the playoffs, it's championship week, and you're randomly tweeting on a Tuesday night.
Well, that last part, Andrew, we're definitely in alignment on because I texted someone that night when it happened, and I was like, I'm not surprised he feels this way, and I know it's Baker, so he's not afraid to say what he feels, but this is the type of thing that I would tell my team the week of in meetings and in the pregame speech of like, help me beat this guy to get revenge. But when I think that it would be more effective than saying it right now. At first, the timing was so weird that I'm like, does he think that Kevin Stefanski said this as opposed to D. Orlando Ledbetter? And that was not the case. But I don't know that I fully agree with Joe Thomas either, because in terms of it being a two-way street, like if a team lets go of a player, releases a player, trades a player, et cetera, I do think that oftentimes the coach will at least reach out and be like, hey, wish you the best of luck, because the coach is in the position of power here, not the player, especially a player on a rookie deal who may not have had the ability to control whether or not they were traded. So I don't know that two-way to me suggests they're making the same amount of money. They're getting the same amount of input in this decision. And I don't think that's reflective of it. But I was kind of curious about more of the context, because I think to me it's interesting to consider what this means when you think of the different ways we viewed Kevin Stefanski. And I really like Kevin. I've gotten to know him some. I don't know Baker so well personally, although we all know who Baker is in terms of his feeling dangerous mentality that he's had since college. And I think that Kevin's been an adult in a lot of rooms that needed adults. But I was curious kind of the history of their relationship. So Mary Kay Cabot, who does a great job reporting on the Browns, had written about it the year that Baker was there. And I had you send it to me, Andrew. And I was reading more of just this, okay, well, Baker thought the play calls were too conservative and he didn't think they were best maximizing what he could do with play action. And also, by the way, he had the shoulder. And then Kevin thought that Baker needed to do some different things. And to me, the question is not like who was right. I don't really care. It's been several years. I personally think it's accurate that Baker's had more success than the Browns. And certainly it's statistically he has, even if he wasn't going to be the right fit there. And even if the Browns decision might have been right at the time. But to me, the question is, what did we learn about Kevin Stefanski and his time with Baker that is relevant to Kevin Stefanski in a new building with the Atlanta Falcons and Kirk Cousins and Michael Penix Jr.? Because would you say it's accurate that Kevin Stefanski had the most success with Joe Flacco of the quarterbacks he had in Cleveland? And if so, does that make us think that Kirk Cousins is more likely to be the guy he wants at the beginning of the season than, say, Michael Penix Jr.? And I know Michael Penix Jr. has to be healthy as well. But that, to me, is interesting when you spin this forward of what can we learn about Kevin in full? Because the Deshaun Watson element in the middle is just, there's so many variables that it's probably never going to be a great apples to apples level of applicability to another circumstance. And so when you think about everything that happened with all of the quarterbacks interpersonally and schematically, because again, I'm reading, Baker wanted Alex Van Pelt to call plays, not Kevin Stefanski. And we know that two other seasons, Kevin Stefanski did give up play calling. So when you think of all of that, what do you think about the way that Kevin will lead the offense and particularly the quarterbacks with the Falcons?
There's a lot there, and those are all very good questions. We should tell the listeners and the viewers right now that Tommy Rees is going to be the new offensive coordinator. That news, somewhat as expected, is breaking as we go to air today. So Tommy was the OC this past season with Kevin. Kevin opened the season calling plays, eventually midseason handed it to Tommy. I felt, and a lot of people around the Browns felt, that it was good. I thought Tommy did a good job, and it was a new set of eyes under different circumstances, certainly with Gabriel and Shedeur Sanders as the quarterbacks. The offense had a little spark with Tommy. Shedeur helped, but Tommy Rees certainly helped as well. I don't know who's going to call plays. We haven't had the introductory press conference yet in Atlanta. I'm going to assume Kevin does, but that remains to be seen. Bill Callahan is also going there, so he's getting the band back together. And I'll say it right now, if it is Kirk Cousins or whomever, I think the Dolphins offense is going to come out of the gates firing next year. I'm sorry, the Dolphins, the Falcons. I think the Falcons offense is going to come out of the gates firing next year. And there's going to be a little bit of, oh, wow, that's what that offense looked like in 2020 with the Browns. Oh, wow, look, they have the pieces. Oh, wow, it is working again. As for how the Browns and Baker went sideways, full disclosure, I work for the Browns. Everyone knows that, but it is worth repeating. I do their play-by-play on the radio. I was not there in 2021. Now, I did go to a game or two. I was on the road for NFL Network for Thursday Night Football, so I saw the Browns up close that year. I saw them when they came to LA as well. They were coming off a playoff season in which Baker was a massive, massive reason they went to the playoffs in 2020. It was a COVID year. They won a game in Pittsburgh. Baker played his tail off. They went to Kansas City. They could have, would have, should have beaten the Chiefs. They didn't get some breaks that should have gone their way. One officiating, another one defensively late in the game when Mahomes was out. They had him. They didn't beat the Chiefs. They lost 22-17. They came into the 2021 season with ridiculously high expectations. Like absurdly high, like Super Bowl high expectations. And it didn't happen. They scored a lot of points, but they didn't win a lot of games. Eventually, defensive coordinator Joe Woods would be fired, not during the season, but the defense didn't do the job that year. And Baker didn't play well. Now, Joey points out the shoulder injury. He tore his labrum, left shoulder, non-throwing shoulder early in the season. He was making a tackle on an interception. Now, the cynic would say, well, Baker, don't throw a pick. Don't have to make the tackle. Dig a little deeper, you might say, hey, Anthony Schwartz, not a good pick as a third-round wide receiver. Cut the route off early. Baker threw to a spot. Schwartz should have been there. Baker ended up having to make the tackle on the return and tore his shoulder. It was awkward all year, from what I am told. I wasn't there, but it went sideways. And everything kind of fell apart in the building. And by the end of 2021, there is a disconnect. It didn't help that OBJ's dad threw Baker under the bus on social media, and Odell didn't come to Baker's defense, right? That cannot be overstated from what I understand. You have a frustrated quarterback who's playing injured. You have a banged up offensive line. You have a team that thought it should be going to the playoffs. And you have a season slipping away. And then you have, on national TV, James Hudson, overmatched at left tackle, a player who was a third-round pick who had started his college career on the defensive side of the ball, switched to offensive tackle. He's now with the Giants, learning to play the position kind of on the fly here. Not really a left tackle. He'd always been a right tackle. Abused by T.J. Watt the entire game on national TV. Baker takes a beating, and then Baker calls out the coaching for not giving James Hudson more help. There had been veiled shots at the play calling throughout the season. My point being that everyone makes it a, well, why'd you get rid of Baker? The thing was broken. And they made the decision, we're going to swing big, like the Rams did with Matthew Stafford. That had worked. And we're going to try to go get Deshaun Watson. That is, as you point out, Jory, independent of their decision to move on from Baker. But they had to make the decision. Because now after, let's see, 18, 19, 20, 21, after year four, I'm counting with my fingers, they had to make the decision whether or not to pay him. And that last year in 21 was a disaster. Go ahead.
So let's bring it back to today, though. What do you think Kevin Stefanski thinks when he hears about this tweet? Because there's no way he didn't hear about Baker's tweet.
Oh, I guarantee you he shrugged his shoulders and laughed on it and says, bring it on. Let's go. I'll see you in September. Guarantee.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if they have communicated. I don't know if Baker's totally off base here. I have no clue whether or not they did text or call. Yeah, I'm with you. A call or text would have been nice. I don't know if it did or didn't happen. Baker says it did not. But I guarantee you, Kevin's probably gone, all right, let's go. Kevin, by the way, is 1-0 against Baker Mayfield. In 2022, okay. Week one, the Browns went to Carolina. Baker was the week one starter. And Cade York hit a 58-yard field goal with 5 seconds left to win the game. Go ahead.
Okay, next question for you. Among our Southern yes. Division rivalries that randomly got spicy, are you more excited mm-hmm. for the Falcons-Bucks between Kevin Stefanski and Baker Mayfield, or the mm-hmm. Titans and Jaguars between Robert Saleh and Liam Cohen, who will now play twice a year after Liam Cohen's like, get my name out of your mouth, and Robert Saleh made it pretty clear he would take care of him if need be. This year.
Okay, so Eric Armstead from the Jaguars is going to join us coming up shortly. I teased this earlier. He played for Saleh. He now plays for Liam Cohen. We asked him that. Full disclosure, we taped it yesterday before this Baker thing hit. But he has a good answer on Liam and Saleh. I thought that I would have answered 24 hours ago that now it's Baker and Kevin. Kevin will always take the high road. He will. Like, he'll be asked about it whenever he meets the media in Atlanta. He will absolutely, unequivocally take the high road here. But, oh, it's going to be good. Which would you choose?
It's a good question. Baker, probably, because I think the others, like, there's a chance they all, like you said, take the high road, or at least publicly are like, yeah, whatever, we're not focused on this, we're focused on winning. And there's no chance Baker does that, it seems. And so I think that Baker will give us plenty to talk about. He can't help himself. And it's one of the reasons we love watching him play.
I'm on Team Baker, but both can be true. Like, I'm on Team Baker, but, like, something had to give there. It was no longer tenable there. And people that like to take shots at the Browns make it sound like Baker left Cleveland and 5 minutes later was a perennial Super Bowl caliber, MVP caliber quarterback. That was not the case. He went to Carolina, bad situation there. He eventually ended up getting cut. He went to LA here with the Rams and had his magical Thursday night. I was in the building for it. It was spectacular. He then got a prove-it deal to battle Kyle Trask for the starting job in Tampa. Okay, it's not as if he was awarded a $100 million contract and say, you're the guy because we know the Browns did you dirty. To Baker's credit, he has played his tail off and earned a subsequent extension, and he's probably earned another one now as well. And I'm happy for him. I've always had a good relationship with him. That said, it was time to move on. And if it still fires or fuels the fire, so be it. All right, let's get to the team in my backyard, not far from where I sit right now, the Los Angeles Chargers of Los Angeles. I think they had a home run, hit a home run with Mike McDaniel as their OC. He pulled his name out of consideration for the Browns' head coaching job yesterday. Remember, he had interviewed for multiple offensive coordinator jobs as well. And now you get the very awkward personality mix of Jim Harbaugh and Mike McDaniel, but you get the potential, Jory, magical combination of McDaniel and Justin Herbert. And I think this is a home run.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's great. I think that Mike McDaniel, we've talked about when you get to the Shanahan-McVay system, a quarterback who really is a great thrower, does do a lot of timing from the pocket. And Justin Herbert's more athletic than people give him credit for, but he does have such an arm that the way he will be able to maximize McDaniel's vision for it is great. And then when you think about the offensive line in Los Angeles, I know that we gave them a lot of flack this year, but if Rashawn Slater and Joe Alt can get healthy, that offensive line would be so key to helping with all the different schemes that Mike McDaniel likes to run. So I like that. And I did think that Mike McDaniel was best fit with a coaching staff where someone was very intense, because I think you should have personality matches. And while Jim Harbaugh was not quite what I was envisioning with that intensity, I think it's great. So I understand why he wanted to do it. And I also think he kind of looks at it the same way that someone would look at working for the Bills or the Ravens, particularly on offense. And if you crush that OC job and you want another head coaching job, you'll have the talent to do it. Detroit's another one. You'll have the talent and so you'll be able to do it. I also think the way this news broke was just funny. And this is a little inside football here, but there were all the insiders, and one would be like, and they're at dinner right now, the Chargers and Mike McDaniel. And then another would be like, and other teams Mike McDaniel is talking to found out. And then someone else would be like, and other candidates the Chargers were talking to. And I know this is how it works and like they're all doing a great job, but it was a fascinating study in how news gets out and who's got who as sources. So
I agree. And I was texting somebody with the Chargers last night as well, because the restaurant is right down the street from where I live. And just going like, why did we choose this restaurant? Why'd you do this one? I would have chosen this on a Tuesday night. Just LA restaurant talk here. And, you know, snark is not analysis. I always like to remind, when I speak to journalism classes or kids, or hey, snark is not analysis. When McDaniel pulled out, it was reported by Tom Pelissero that McDaniel would take his name out of the running for the Browns head coaching job yesterday. There was a lot of snark. Well, you don't want that job. Of course you don't want that job. Browns get denied again. No, guys, it's because he gets the chance to live in Manhattan Beach and drive 3 minutes to work, and Stephen Ross gets to pay for it. You want to go play with Justin Herbert and live in Manhattan Beach and drive 3 minutes to work? Or do you want to take over any head coaching job for a team that may not have a quarterback, like whether it be Atlanta? I know Atlanta's job is taken, or whether it be Cleveland, whether it be wherever. Like, what a great rehab year. What a great, like, get back on your feet year as a play caller, as a coach. Live in Manhattan Beach and call plays for Justin Herbert, and somebody else pays for it. You kidding me? Like, what a great gig for Mike McDaniel. And the full Herbert McDaniel, like, draft circle. I'm sorry, Herbert to a draft circle gets closed.
Yeah, one pick.
I think it's great. Yeah. And also put the Hard Knocks cameras in there, please, because the awkwardness of Harbaugh. And Jory, you've talked to him before. Like that. Like the awkwardness and the intensity of Harbaugh, and like the cuffed Viore, or maybe it's Allo, or maybe it's Lulu joggers of one Mike McDaniel just coming together. I want cameras.
There you go.
Okay. Coming up, Eric Armstead of the Jacksonville Jaguars, also coming up. Time for one more thing before we go with an Olympic twist. Don't go anywhere. Back on another edition here of Inside Coverage. Very happy to be joined by a guy that just wrapped up a season with the Jacksonville Jaguars. He also did so with the big Walter Payton Man of the Year Award winner logo, the big patch on his jersey down there in Jacksonville. Joining us now from Florida, it is Jaguars defensive lineman Eric Armstead. Good to see you, man. How are you?
Good to see you, man, as well. It's been a little minute.
It has been a minute. Last saw you, I'm trying to think, in New Orleans last year. So the day after you won the Walter Payton Man of the Year Award at NFL Honors. And I mentioned that patch. Like, what kind of cool honor was it to take the field every week this year with that on your shoulder?
It was amazing to be honored in that way and be able to be distinct, I guess, in a sense, you know. You know, a lot of people ask for my jersey, but you know, my jersey was a little different this year. And it's not something that you see on the field very often. There's only still active, only a few of us, maybe four. So yeah, it's definitely a huge honor and something that I take pride in wearing. And, you know, when every time I suit up and go out there on that field and I see it, on my jersey, and it's a cool experience.
Did you ever have a moment this year where maybe you got flagged, or maybe you got in somebody's face, or maybe, I don't know, did you have a personal foul here or there where somebody said, come on, man, that's unbecoming?
For sure. Definitely it saved me earlier in the season. I want to say maybe week one, I think. We're playing against Bryce Young and the Panthers, and I got a QB hit. I got to him, but it was, you know, kind of questionable. I could have, you know, possibly let off a little bit. But the ref, he knows, he knew my character. He knew my intent. And he was like, hey, Eric. I was like, my bad. I got you. My bad.
Dude, you sacking or hitting Bryce Young. I'm allowed to say this. I'm not a big human as well. You know, we've joked about this. You hitting Bryce Young almost doesn't seem unfair. Rather, it almost seems unfair. It's almost as if you're playing a different sport than Bryce Young. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I I've been experiencing that for quite some time too. You know, my mom actually growing up when I used to play football, especially in high school, and once I got good, my mom would literally tell me like, "Don't hurt them little kids out there." Like she would feel she would feel worse for the kids that I was playing against, you know, rather than me at sometimes. But no, she would literally tell me like, Eric, just don't hurt those kids out there, because definitely was some lopsided matchups.
I can see that. And Bryce, by the way, balled out this year, took his team to the postseason, and good for him. I'm happy for Bryce Young. He just is not the biggest dude, and you are one of the biggest dudes. Talking to Eric Armstead here at the Jaguars. A week later, after watching Divisional Weekend from the couch, if you did even watch it, how do you process the season you guys had and the way it ended?
I process it. I've been in, some situation like this before, losing, not knowing when your season is going to be over, and then it is over and you're shocked because you know the team you had and you know the ultimate goal is ending, with the Super Bowl win and wanting that experience. But, also at the end of the day too, I'm a big football fan, and so like you want to be mad, you want to be upset, and then the game's on and like you see it and it's like, dang, that's some good football. I gotta tune in. I want to see what happens. And so, I watched a few of the games, and one thing, my takeaway was that a lot of great teams this season, but I feel no one is extremely dominant. And on any given Sunday, I feel like any of these playoff teams can beat anybody. And that's kind of how I felt with our season and, losing in the first round. It was like any given Sunday, we beat the Bills. Any given Sunday, they beat us too, which is what happened. And so that's just the way football breaks your heart at times. It's like you can't put a finger on why you didn't win necessarily. It just didn't go your way that day. But I think there's a lot of teams in this playoff that are, equal and great teams, but no one is, really jumping off as like extremely dominant.
It's funny you say that because, going back to the schedule, you guys played everyone here. Obviously, you went to Denver. You dominated Denver. Your losses to the NFC West teams came before your bye and after the bye. Obviously, you guys were a better team. You were on a heater. You don't think the Seahawks and Rams are dominant teams or can be dominant teams? Because, Eric, honestly, I look at the NFC Championship game with the famous, all due respect to the teams left in the AFC. I look at that game in Seattle on Sunday. I'm like, that's kind of the Super Bowl a week early.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, definitely great teams. But, when I'm looking at, back at history of dominance and teams that's like, man, it's just, they just overpower and it's like just too much for the entire league. You don't really see that. I personally don't really see that. We played against Seattle, great team. They beat us. They're built for the playoffs, run the football. Darnold doesn't turn the ball over. They take deep shots off down the field off of their run game. Amazing, fast defense, playmakers on all three levels. And they're built the right way. I just, looking at the league this year, I think there was a lot of great teams. But maybe, that could be an equation that there's just a lot of good quality teams. And, so maybe it was more even. There's just, more good teams, not those few teams that's like, okay, yeah, they're going to win the Super Bowl. They're just that much better than everyone, you know?
No, no, I totally get it. There's not a lot of sympathy in this league. Maybe some empathy, though, potentially here for the Denver Broncos, the way they have to go into this AFC Championship game. They don't have their quarterback. Bo Nix is out. It's going to be Jarrett Stidham. I don't know that it's the same, but you've been in a situation where you're in a conference championship game and you don't have your quarterback, obviously with the 49ers and the Eagles there.
Don't have a quarterback at all.
I mean, they changed the rules because of that, roster management rules. Do you, can you all at all put yourself in the Broncos' shoes to understand what they're going with, they're through?
Maybe a little bit. You know, ours happened early in the game, and so, you know, they're going to have a week of preparation knowing what they're getting into. So a little bit of a different situation. But when I look at the Broncos, I feel the way that they're built through their defense and on offense, you know, that court, Bo hasn't really played like hero, Superman football at that position. You know, they're not really built offensively to do that. I think they run the football, they move the pocket, they take deep shots down the field at different points in the game. Very good at running various screens and getting the ball out quick. And so I think having an offense like that, and it hasn't always been on the shoulders of the quarterback to make all these, you know, outstanding, huge plays, I think is a situation that kind of is in their favor. You know, the best possible kind of situation outcome for what they're in right now. And, you know, Jarrett Stidham, I will admit that I forgot that I played against him.
Okay.
In 22 season. He started for the Raiders, and I didn't remember this until I saw it on Instagram a couple days ago. Like, he lit us up. Like, he threw for like 300 on us, and we were the, you know, number one defense in the NFL at that time when I was, you know, still in the Niners. And so he has some ability. And so, yeah, so someone that's played against him and had experience of him having a really good game, you know, there's something there. So we'll see.
Let's talk about your team, Eric Armstead. Let's talk about the Jaguars. The light went on after the bye. As I mentioned, you guys got on a heater. Trevor was playing his best football. Your defense clearly stepped up as well, kind of coming together. What's it going to take for this team? Now that you've got the taste of the postseason again, right? Now that Trevor seemingly has got his groove back and that him and Liam are on the same page, what's it going to take to go further next year?
I think finding out, I think, you know, the game changes throughout the year. I think, you know, once you get into the playoffs, things tighten up, you know, a lot. And, you know, us taking that next step is continuing that journey of, you know, proving to yourself what you're capable of, going out there and doing it. You know, it's going to take us being in that moment again and finding a way to execute and win a game like that to, you know, turn over the belief in what you're capable of. But, you know, we look at our season this year, you know, look at some of the teams that we beat. We beat a lot of playoff teams. And, you know, I think that being a first year together, there's going to be some tweaks. There's going to be some, okay, we did this way, but how can we improve in this area? And figuring that out is the journey that it's fun to be on. And so things are very promising. Things are, you know, looking to the future is a good spot to be.
I had someone tell me recently that your team, as the season progressed, kind of took on the personality of your coach. I'm not saying that Liam told Logan Cook to threaten another man's life on the field, but that that his swag, what a lot of people thought was awkwardness in his initial press conference, his swag, his attitude kind of permeated the entire building. For when people ask you, Eric, what's Liam Cohen like? What do you tell them?
I'll say he's very approachable, a player's coach, someone that you could talk to and have a conversation with. And also, too, you know, I knew this kind of going into it, like how passionate, being a first timer at anything, like, and, you know, you have this dream of doing this at the highest level. Like being a head coach in the NFL is only 32 of them. And if that was your dream, like this is your first opportunity, you're going to go, you know, balls to the wall. And with our same thing with our coordinators and you know, our whole organization, like we had a lot of first timers. So bringing that energy, that fieriness, that something to prove, that chip on your shoulder, that edge, permeated through all of us. And, you know, anytime you're trying to get something turned around and changed, it's going to take it starts with a change of your mindset and your mentality. And I think he did a great job preparing us each and every week with that, especially.
Anthony Campanelli, part of that as well. Is he going to be a head coach one day?
I definitely think Camp has the makings of being a head coach one day. You know how the cycles kind of go. You know, you put your name in the hat. You go through, you know, those interviews and getting a couple interviews after being a coordinator for 1 year. You know, that's pretty rare and unheard of. And so, yeah, Camp is definitely going to be a head coach one day. I can't wait to see it for him. He's an amazing person. Truly cares about the people that he's around. And he commands whatever he's doing, whatever. If Camp was if he was in the tech field, he would be commanding and leading that group. If he was in, whatever spaces, if he was a firefighter, he'd probably be the first person, you know, that everyone looked to, in moments. And so he has that leadership and that ability to connect. Be very intense and passionate and caring and loving all at the same time. And so I think he definitely has the makings of being a head coach.
Is he the guy from the Hard Knocks video? Can he go? You saw that, right, with the Dolphins?
Yeah.
He go more than 20 seconds without cursing?
No, he can't. We got to get the F-bomb counter on him for sure in one of our next meetings. We used to do that in my past. Every Kyle Shanahan team meeting the night before the game, Trent Williams would have a paper and he would start tallying the F-bombs. And so, yeah, we definitely got to get that with Camp, too, because it'd be pretty crazy.
Hold on. What was Kyle's record?
Man, I kid you not. One time, it may have been a playoff game or, like, we were playing, like, a rival or someone that we had played, like, multiple times. And it was over like 130.
130?
Yes.
How long was this meeting?
This one went a little long-winded because he likes to watch film, you know. And we used to have, you know, little over-unders. You know, you take an over on the under and we would set it. I think we used to set it around like 50, the 50-ish range. One time he got to like 130.
And Trent was the official keeper of
this
tally?
Yeah, Trent was the official scorecard.
And no actual gambling, recreational purposes only, of course.
Yeah. No, okay. No. Just a friendly, like, you know, over-under. You know, not really gambling, just what you taking the over on the under on 63 F-bombs.
Dude, this had to have been a Rams game, wasn't it?
It might have been.
That sounds like it Kyle been. Rams
Either
game.
It was Rams, Cowboy. It was a division. It was a big game because he went to... He goes on deep dives. He'll be watching film from like we played against him like 9 years prior, or you know, he's going back into when the last time the Cowboys played the Niners in like in the 70s and 80s, and he's trying to paint the whole picture for game day.
Yeah, he's unique. So too is Robert Saleh, and obviously you played for him there. Let's unpack this now real quick. You this year, you guys went up there, you beat them. You had a huge play at the end of the game, strip sack. And then Sala and Liam had their words after the game. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they didn't like, or Liam didn't like what Sala had said on the podium earlier in the week. Mm-hmm. Robert Sala is going to be in the division, Eric. Yeah. He's the new head coach of Tennessee. So Liam Cohen, your head coach, and Robert Sala get to see each other now twice a year. How's that going to go?
I think it's going to be cool. I think this offseason, you get to the owners' meetings, you know, they get around each other. It'll, you know, they can have some conversations. I definitely think they both respect each other a lot from my conversations with both of them. I think it's going to be cool. Definitely extremely happy for Sala. I was talking to him, just supporting him and really happy for him to be a head coach again. I think he's a amazing coach. In terms of the beef, I think they get to those NFL meetings and, you know, they see the mutual respect that one another have, and it'll be all good.
So, like, squash it at the Monday night cocktail party at the meetings, and that's it?
I think they'll be good. I mean, they're going to have to see each other. So.
Yeah, twice a year, you're going to be there. let's talk to people about what you're doing. Obviously, you've got your podcast, you've got The Third and Long, but as part of the Walter Payton Man of the Year family, you and the NFL got together and did something on their YouTube page now, which is this new series, which I think is really cool. It's called The Humanity Show. Mm-hmm. And you've done an episode with Larry Fitzgerald. You got one coming up with Bobby Wagner. It's about the community. It's about philanthropy. It's about giving back. Tell me about that, man.
Yeah, it was an idea I had I truly believe in getting into the community and doing work and inspiring people that way, but also shining a light on other people who are doing amazing work and being able to myself learn from them, but also record that and put it out to the public so people can be inspired as well. I think we have some special, amazing men in this league, and, you know, being able to learn from them has been awesome throughout the show, and be able to find different ways that I can have impact in my community. And that's what I hope viewers take and gain from viewing the show, is that, you know, you can create change as well too. You can be inspired from this and go in your community to create change. And so this is a show that is launching with the NFL, but something I want to continue to do for years and years is shining a light on amazing people who do the amazing work in our communities in various ways. I choose to have impact in education, but there's so many causes and areas of our society that need people to want them to see better and create change. And so that's what I love about the show, because I'm able to highlight those and also inspire people to want to do something similar and create change in their area.
No, man, it's what we love about you as well. You are not just a slogan on a hoodie that everybody has to wear 1 or 2 weeks a year on the sideline, and you're not just a slogan on the back of a helmet or behind an end zone. Obviously, you're doing real work in the community. Walter Payton Man of the Year Award or not, it is who you are. It is what drives you. It's what makes you you, Eric Armstead. Mm-hmm. Keep doing that, please. And congratulations on a great year there with the Jaguars. Hope you get some time off in the offseason.
I appreciate you. Appreciate you for having me on the show. And it's always great to see you. Our journeys have crossed many years ago, my rookie year, or actually pre-draft.
It was before the draft. You were at the network. Yeah, I was looking before for that photo today for our producer, Madison, to try to put it up. And maybe we'll find it and we'll stick it in there when we actually run.
I think I might have it on my phone, so I'll look forward to it, and if I find it, I can send it to you. But yeah, it's always great to see you, man.
Likewise, Eric Armstead. Love me some Eric Armstead, Walter Payton Man of the Year Award winner. Time for one more thing before we go.
Lori Epstein, you go first.
Yeah, Kyle Shanahan and John Lynch talked in San Francisco today, wrapping up the 49ers season. And they did talk about receiver Brandon Ayuk, who had not been with the team the entire season. There are some rehab elements, there are some contract elements. And I think just we are not going to have all of the details now, and they don't even understand it all. So we're not going to understand it. But I give the 49ers credit for not letting this become more of a distraction than it was. I think that, yes, from a skill set standpoint, they would have benefited from having a healthy Brandon Ayuk on the field. But there are a lot of teams who, if a player kind of took a stance or really felt like they wanted things their way, the team would bend to that player. And I'm not saying that you should never do that, but I do think credit to the 49ers for finding ways, both schematically and culturally, to kind of keep the ship moving, keep making it. And despite all the injuries and the absences of players like Brandon Ayuk, they still made a playoff run. And then just from a housekeeping standpoint, they did mention that he's not going to be with the team next year. So functionally, he wasn't with the team this year, but contractually, he will not be there next year either.
That ship has sailed. Kyle Shanahan said he's never seen anything like it in his 22 years. John Lynch also, by the way, said they at least have to look into the crazy viral story that the power station next door is causing all their injuries. Guys, they've played there for 40 years. Okay. I mean, they practiced there for 40 years. It's not an issue. Take off your tinfoil hats. That's just my opinion. My one more thing. How cool is it that the Kelseys, Jason and Travis of Cleveland Heights, Ohio, are helping take the family of U.S. Olympian and hockey player Layla Edwards from Cleveland Heights, Ohio, to Milan to watch the Olympics. They gave Layla, 21 years old, who won two national championships at Wisconsin, a shout out on the show, had mentioned a GoFundMe because she wants the whole family, a hockey playing family, to be able to go see her play and wear the red, white, and blue. They mentioned the GoFundMe, money flowing into the GoFundMe. The Kelseys have contributed as well. Kind of cool here as we all get ready for the Olympics and we all get ready to bring home some gold from Milan and Cortina. Layla Edwards and Team USA among the favorites to win said gold. Jory, we haven't really talked about the games. You want to do that tomorrow?
Let's do it tomorrow. I actually will not be on tomorrow. You'll have to do it without me. But you and Charles and Ben should definitely do that tomorrow. And I will be listening.
Okay. You could like text in or something if you want.
Yeah, yeah. I'll be like, okay. Here are my thoughts. Yeah. Here's my thoughts on Jared Stidham.
Okay, and while you listen on 2x speed on your run. For Jory Epstein, I'm Andrew Siciliano. We appreciate you participating, listening, and watching, and joining us today on Inside Coverage.